From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Dr. Willie Parker is a Southerner, a lifelong Christian, and a doctor who performs abortions.
My commitment to my work, my sense of integrity about it, is rooted in my Christian and religious understandings. When you have a sense of duty about what you do, it kind of allows you to ignore the naysayers.
In his new book, A Life's Work, he makes what he says is a moral argument for abortion. Also today, affirmative action in college admissions. Who benefits, who doesn't? And what purpose does it actually serve? A Harvard educator asked newly admitted college students themselves, and their answers surprised her. And Hollywood's embrace of Sean Spicer.
This will be the largest audience to witness an Emmys, period.
We say, not funny, period. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Willie Parker is a Christian. He's also a physician. And he's a doctor who performs abortions. And he performs the procedure in states such as Alabama, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Illinois, and Mississippi. Mississippi in particular, where there is just one abortion clinic in the entire state. And in his new book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice, Dr. Parker talks about the decades of emotional, spiritual, and intellectual struggle that helped him entwine his faith and his work. I remain a follower of Jesus, he writes, and I believe that as an abortion provider, I am doing God's work. Dr. Parker joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So Dr. Parker, if I just may start, that last line, that line that I wrote from your book, where you believe that as an abortion provider, you are doing God's work, that probably sounds shocking to the ears of many listeners. So why do you believe you're doing God's work?
Well, it's only shocking if you compartmentalize your life and say that there are things that place people beyond the need for help and compassion. And so when I say that if what it means to be concerned about others in fulfillment of a passage in Christian text that says, first love God with all your heart and then love your neighbor as yourself. It is difficult to profess love for God whom you've never seen and to be oblivious to the need of your neighbor. I think what's different about me and most people who say that they're compelled by Christian compassion to address issues that they see is that I don't put the basic reproductive health needs of women beyond the reach of compassion that I derive from my Christianity, whereas other people simply do.
So talk to me more about that, because in the highly polarized language of abortion in this country for several generations now, when moral arguments have been made, religiously founded moral arguments, they've almost always been made in opposition to abortion, that it's the moral sanctity of the fetus which takes precedence. So why did your Christianity, your faith, your path bring you to a different conclusion?
Well, precisely because, as you just implied, the people assume that the opposition to abortion from a religious standpoint is rooted in antiquity in a way that it is not. And in fact, the position of Protestant Christians, the notion that they had any overriding concern about abortion at all is relatively recent. It comes out of the morphing of the moral majority whose original impetus was towards supporting segregation, Jerry Falwell and the like. And in 1978, they message tested and found that in terms of mobilizing people politically, the framing of abortion as a moral evil resulted in their ability to mobilize the electorate to elect Ronald Reagan as the president. So this ahistorical notion of abortion being immoral is ironic given the fact that we now have legal abortion based on the actions of the Clergy Consultation Service out of New York City, which 50 years ago this year openly advocated for abortion in a clandestine manner, for safe abortion for poor women and women of color, to get access that ultimately resulted in abortion being legalized in this country. So it's kind of like, again, an ahistoric narrative, yeah, and also one that is politically convenient, but it roots in religious understanding and a moralizing about reproduction that just isn't there.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you make a good point that the truth is more complex than sort of our popular understanding of this long debate oftentimes tends to be. So, but let's talk a little bit more about your faith and your journey here, because it's what you write about in the book. I mean, you say that you didn't always feel this way, that it was something about a dozen years ago or so you had your quote unquote come to Jesus moment around this issue. I mean, what happened?
So I describe it that way, kind of tongue in cheek,
yeah,
because but in seriousness, the profundity of my clarity around deciding that there was nothing mutually exclusive about being Christian and being compassionate towards women who needed abortion was as profound for me as my religious conversion. And what it really came down to was I felt cornered and forced to do a values clarification while working in a clinic that provided abortion care for women in the state of Hawaii, which had done so since 1970, as Hawaii was one of the first states to legalize abortion. And I say I was cornered and prompted to a values clarification because it was the first time that I was put in a position where, as a women's health provider and as a Christian, where I had to explore what it meant to be responsible for a woman's care and to now face an administrator who shared my Christian identity but who derived a different conclusion about the morality of abortion. That person was cutting it off. And so what it prompted me to do is to look more deeply into my faith tradition and to see if there was anything explicit prohibiting abortion and if there was anything mutually exclusive about having a faith identity and doing it. And I ultimately came to conclude that there was not. And more importantly, what was at risk for being compromised was the ability to ignore the compassion that I felt for my patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I decided that there was nothing mutually exclusive about doing abortions and being a Christian, and in fact, the opposition is largely patriarchal control over the lives of women that had been posited into Christianity, but there was nothing doctrinally essential about being opposed to abortion. I then decided it was not enough or it was not justifiable for me to simply deny women access out of concern about what other people who share my Christian identity would think, because I chose to act on the compassion that I derived from my identity on behalf of women who needed abortions.
You know, and I hope this isn't inappropriate for me to make this distinction, but you self-identify as your Christian identity, because I would say that we probably in this audience have a great deal of Catholic listeners who would say that there is Catholic doctrine that they follow from the Vatican that says that that puts the Catholic Church in opposition to abortion. But you don't think that there's necessarily any strict, I don't know, a Protestant Christian doctrine on this?
Not rooted in the antiquity that people are now clearing. And even I think to think about Catholicism in a monolithic, non-heterogeneous way would be to disavow the fact that Catholics for Church, based in D.C., and they have an explicit and active support of women who are Catholic and who are observant of their faith, who also have abortions. 98% of Catholics in this country use contraception. And so even the Pope, the new Pope, in a special dispensation said, you know, there's no reason for women of the Catholic faith who have felt outside of the faith tradition by simply because they had an abortion to continue to feel such. And he, in a special dispensation, absolved those women prior to who had had abortion to say that you are in fellowship with the Catholic Church. He didn't change canon law or the Catholic doctrine about abortion, but he did say that there's very little that puts anybody beyond the love of God and the compassion that God has. Mm-hmm. In the Catholic Church allowed him as the representative for God to bring those women back into fellowship. So I think to think about any religious tradition in a monolithic and non-interpretive way is to abandon the moral authority that all religions should reinforce for people who observe it and for those who don't necessarily share that tradition.
So let me ask you about, you talk about in the book how a speech from Dr. Martin Luther King, I believe it was his last major speech, 1968, the I've Been to the Mountaintop speech.
Sure.
How that factored into your thinking about the Christian moral argument for abortion, as you make it. And before actually we talk about that, I have a clip here from that speech.
Sure.
If I could play. Again, this is Dr. Martin Luther King, 1968, a portion from the I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech. And here he's talking about the parable of the Good Samaritan. And of course, that's the one where it's the story of a man lying woundless and wounded and helpless on the roadside. And two men pass him by and don't help him. And the Good Samaritan ultimately does. And here's what Dr. King says about that.
You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him?
Dr. Parker, how...
I'm sorry,
you
I was having a moment.
Moved right here. How does this... How did what Dr. King say link to your work on reproductive rights?
Well, in the way in which the power of spirituality has to stir and move you from the inside, the Good Samaritan narrative has striking parallels to the role I found myself in. For the Samaritan, the wounded, the person in need was the wounded traveler. For me, it has been women asking for my help. When I did my values clarification, I decided that there should be nothing that should place people beyond help and being deserving of help. I became less concerned about what people would think, and I became convinced that the most essential characteristic defining Christianity should be love and compassion, not judgment and punishment, and not inflexibility. And so I understand that everybody doesn't hear what I hear, but I'm only accountable to the way in which I feel moved by sacred text.
So is it that you see laws that restrict access to abortion as judgment and punishment?
When you look at the fact that they are set forth in direct opposition to the fact that we know that abortion is life-saving for women who need it, that is one of the safest procedures, is one of the most common procedures. And I see that when we know what happens to women when abortion is illegal and inaccessible, to press forward under the notion that a woman who seeks abortion despite its legal status is not deserving of protection and health and well-being. And so what could it be but punishment if I make the case and the argument that abortion is necessary, and you say, despite that argument, we are going to press forward and imperil women by making unavailable? That feels judgmental and harsh and punitive to me.
Because, you know, I ask that because thinking back to the last line of that bit of tape from Dr. King that we played, where he asks the question, if I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him, that there are many people who read that line and say, but therein lies the Christian argument in opposition to abortion, right? Because the man in this case would be the fetus. And there's, you know, they're saying that they have to speak for on behalf of the fetus because the fetus can't speak. The fetus can't vote. It doesn't have any say in terms of what happens to it. And that is their moral argument, their Christian moral argument in opposition to abortion.
Well, they can talk about fetuses, but the man in this person is in this story is a person. And what's problematic for me that even if people who fetishize fetuses and are indifferent to the women who carry them, what would be problematic if I conceded that a fetus is a person on par with the woman carrying it, the problem still remains is how do you give rights to a fetus to a person that's inside of a person without taking rights from the person that the person is inside of? So it then begs the question of what does it mean to be a person? What does it mean to have bodily autonomy and to have bodily integrity and to have sovereign will? I think you can't care more about a fetus than you do about the woman who's carrying it. So the question for me in that scenario, which is someone's subjective right to say that a fetus is a person, that's not rooted in law. That's not even rooted in a direct representation of the value of fetal life. Even in Christian texts, if a pregnancy is lost in the context of a battle between two men and the woman is injured and loses her pregnancy, there's a tort claim around the loss of a property, but not a claim of murder and the requirement for execution. If the woman's life is lost, then the person's culpable for execution. So my whole point is within the sacred text, the room for interpretation means that we're all entitled to our own opinions, but none of us entitled to our own facts. And what it means to have conscience and to have sovereignty is that we all have to be governed by the dictates of our own consciences, not that of someone else who interacts with the same sacred text and sees it a different way.
This is an issue that, of course, you've dedicated your life's work to now, but it also intersects with your personal life in a very deep way. I mean, in the mm-hmm. book, you talk about what happened to your sister, right, when she was mm-hmm. just 14. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. So my youngest sister became pregnant my senior year in high school, and unbeknownst to me, my siblings, who were, in my opinion, more reality-based at that time, I was in the deep throes of my fundamentalism as a Christian, and I was very absolute and very rigid and strict. And even though I didn't have any personal teaching that abortion was wrong, I was very harsh mentally judgmental of my sister. And I felt because I was judgmental and knew that my sister admired me a great deal, my being indifferent to her was deeply painful to her. And then when I realized what I had done in later years, that I'd been extremely uncharitable and not compassionate and cruel to my sister, that informs how I seek to restore the dignity of the women that I care for. And I understand what those women face because I understand what it felt like to be someone who's so harshly critical of someone who's just making the best decisions that they can make. So I think somebody said that experience is not what happens to you. Experience is what you do with what happens to you. And I utilized that experience of what it felt like to judge and to isolate my sister to have deeper compassion for the women that I provide care for.
There's so much to talk with you about. I wish I had more time. But so let me ask you, you perform abortion in states, and I mentioned at the very top of our conversation, in places such as Mississippi, where there's just one abortion clinic in the entire state. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the women who come, what it's like to work there, just sort of what it's like.
Sure. Yeah. So I no longer work in Mississippi because now there are three doctors there. I'm still involved with the legal processes to keep that clinic open. But as where I do work and what the women in Mississippi and a lot of women in rural southern states have in common is the laws often make it difficult for them to access medically accurate sex education, contraception, not to mention making abortion all but impossible to access. There's no funding to support women who are vulnerable and on Medicaid, who are more likely to have unplanned pregnancies. And so it means that women who are living in poverty and abject circumstances, many of whom are already mothers, are now, when they have an unplanned pregnancy, they have to make decisions about whether or not to safely end their pregnancies that they can't care for at the expense of other obligations they have. But at the end of the day, while those women tend to be poor women and women of color, I've seen women of all spectrums, because the reality is unplanned, unwanted pregnancy or wanted, but lethally flawed pregnancy happens to all women of reproductive age who have unprotected intercourse. And so what I usually tell my audience is, when they're trying to figure out who are the women that I serve, I say, if you look in the mirror and you're a female, you see the people that I take care of. They're just like you and I. When I lived in D.C., I took care of lawyers and doctors and staffers on the Hill, and I took care of teen and young teens who had their first pregnancy from Southeast D.C. So what all women have in common around this experience of being female in a society that stigmatizes and shames healthcare in the form of abortion or the sexuality of women in ways that it doesn't for men, is that they are all at risk for being denied control of their bodies. And so the women in Mississippi are just like the women in Boston.
So do you think, trying to figure out the right way to ask this. When I hear you say women being denied control of their bodies, I just think of, and perhaps you wouldn't be the first person to make this argument, but American history is marked by a very, very long period in which, you know, the country denied control over the over individuals' control over their bodies through the form of slavery. I mean, is that taking it too far?
No, that's right down. That's a softball for me, because I often feel animosity and hate from people who draw back at the assertion that what makes reproductive control and slavery analogous is that, as Dr. King said about what was immoral about slavery, was that slavery relegated human beings to the status of things. They were made means and not ends. I can personally make myself a means, but no one else should. And so when women are denied control of their bodies and they are forced to continue pregnancies by being subordinated to the interests of the pregnancy that they're carrying, they're relegated to the status of things. They become incubators. They become means to an end. And in the same way that that was the major indictment against slavery as a form of inhumanity, to force women into motherhood or to continue pregnancies that are deleterious to their health in multiple ways, is to relegate them to the status of things. Mm. And so it's on that same basis that I make the moral argument for women having control of their reproductive lives by having access to the full range of reproductive health services.
Now, forgive me if I'm repeating myself here, but I'm listening carefully to what you're saying, and I can't help but to think that there are a lot of people who say the problem is that the fetus has been relegated to the status of a thing. And again, we sort of talked about this before, but so let me just ask you, I mean, in your opinion, mm-hmm. either in your faith opinion or your medical opinion, mm-hmm. when does life begin then?
Well, let me contextualize it. The way you ask the question, you're asking question the initiation of life as if it is an event and an episode.
I mean, lots of people would say it is.
Well, and they're entitled to their opinions. But the reality is, life is a process. It's a series of contingent interrelational events. For example, if you say life begins at conception and there's a spark of life, then what you mean by life, sperm are alive and eggs are alive. In order to get a live conception, you have to have a live egg and a live sperm. Well, if both the egg and the sperm have to be alive, obviously life does not begin at conception. Life began a long time ago. And so life is a process. It's a series of beginnings and endings, and that we would elevate or focus in on one particular event for the point of making persuasion, oftentimes for political reasons, is just a less nuanced approach to that the notion of what life is than I care to engage in. That that particular understanding is perilous for women means that it is problematic for me and for women who are at risk when people decide that life begins at the moment of conception. And as a result of that, they can depersonalize the woman in whose body that process is occurring in. So yeah. I get it, and I understand what people are implying when they say life begins at conception, but what they're really implying is that personhood and all that that entails also begins at conception. And again, I go back to what is problematic about that is that in the process of making that declaration, you have to depersonalize the women carrying pregnancies in order to personalize the fetuses that they carry.
Yeah, this is such a complicated and enormous issue in this country, and your perspective is so unique on it. Forgive me if I've been sort of jumping all over the map in this conversation, but there's a couple more things I did want to explore with you, and one of them is in the book. You actually tell elite, affluent, liberal women that they, in part, need to carry some responsibility in terms of attitudes about pregnancy and motherhood.
So I'm not making an indictment against people who are where they are achieving their reproductive life goals. But what I'm calling for is a mindfulness all around how if your particular lived experience doesn't reflect the implications of your indifference or your assent to policies that subordinate women in their own lives, you bear a responsibility in the same way that I, as a man, am aware that there's rape culture. As a non-rapist, I sleep very well at night. But in order for us to create a world that is free of rape, I have to become anti-rapist. So what I'm calling for, what that calls for from me, is a mindfulness about what it means to be a man in a society that has rape culture. Mm. And what it calls for a middle-class woman who has all of her, all of the needs that go into considering whether or not to procreate, I'm calling for from them a mindfulness about making sure that they cannot be indifferent to the lives of women who don't have the same degree of control. So if you live in New York or Boston, you have access to all of your needs being met. Don't be indifferent to the fact of what a 24-hour waiting period means to a woman living in Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, to put it more, I think you're being quite gentle there, right? Because I think isn't part of what you were saying is that like there are folks out there who fetishize motherhood because they can.
Absolutely.
And so, and that therefore that may inadvertently play into the hands of more conservative folks who say, look, motherhood is this sacred thing, so therefore it has to be protected at all costs.
Absolutely.
So finally, Dr. Parker, again. I've been all over the map. This is just like the most fascinating and interesting conversation I've had in a while. And I just guess the last thing I want to ask you is if you, and perhaps you've done this before, but if you were to be speaking to, you know, members of your faith community who disagree with you and who say it is against the teachings of Jesus, it is unchristian to be a doctor who performs abortions, what would you point to try and convince them to your way of thinking?
I would point them to the tradition of the very person in whose life history and life story that we hang our sense of spirituality. Jesus was not a Christian. He was a Jew. And part of his approach to his spirituality was that he refused to be more of a Jew than he was a human being. And so when it came to specific laws and rules that he thought were not reflective of a more deeply and humane reality, like whether or not people should be fed on the Sabbath, he broke those laws in pursuit of a deeper humanity. And so I would say the things that you assume Jesus said or that you assume that he stands for, if you take a deeper look and see how those things conflict with your humanity, if you can draw at the same conclusion, then I can respect the thoughtfulness with which you hold your position. But I ask that before you criticize me, that you look more deeply into the tradition as I have and say, what is more consistent with humanity, love and compassion or judgment and indifference? And that would be my response to my critics.
Well, Dr. Willie Parker, his new book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. He'll be speaking tomorrow night in Brookline. We've got more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Dr. Parker, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, we've had multiple policy debates over the pros and cons of affirmative action in college admissions. We've done that a lot on this show, and we will certainly have more. But what do current college students themselves think about it? Well, that's the question Natasha Wariku asked students recently, and some of these are students who had been admitted into some of the nation's, or even I should say the world's, most elite universities. And she chronicles their answers in her book, The Diversity Bargain, and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Wariku is an associate professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, who'd you talk to?
So we talked to students, undergraduates on the Harvard, Brown, and Oxford campuses, and we talked to students from a range of backgrounds. These were all students who were born in the United States, in the U.S., and for in the U.K., U.K.-born students, but also talked to a bunch of both white students and students of color.
Okay. So then help us break down their answers a little bit. What did they say about – were they for? Were they against? What were their thoughts about affirmative action?
So I'll talk about the United States,
yeah.
Because in Britain, there really is no affirmative action and there was no support for it among students, whether class or race-based. And in the United States, students were more likely than the average American to support affirmative action. But they did so, and their justification was that, well, it creates this diverse learning environment, and that's good for me because I know that I need to be exposed to a broad range of perspectives in order to be a well-educated kind of citizen of the world.
Okay, so hang on, let me jump in here. So they saw the creation of a diverse learning environment as positive because it was good for them.
That's right, yes.
Not necessarily good for the students who were given access to elite educations.
Yes. I mean, I should say that there were a range of perspectives, but this was the most common one and the most widely shared.
That actually kind of, I have to be honest, that surprises me. Because, I mean, these are, how old were these students when you talked to them?
They're, you know, between 18 and 21.
And this was in the past couple of years.
That's right.
So they have grown up steeped in a culture, in a society that's had affirmative action debates for pretty much most of their lives.
Yeah.
And one would think that maybe we're messaging in the wrong way. I don't know. The common political argument is that affirmative action exists so that in part it's good for the students who deserve greater access to these elite institutions, but that's not why these students say it's a good program?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there are, you know, I think the kind of public debate is often about this question that you're talking about. But in higher education, part of the way that universities tend to talk about admissions is through this diversity argument. And part of this dates back to the way that affirmative action has been dealt with in the U.S. Supreme Court. So if we go back to the late 1970s, the Bakke decision, where the U.S. Supreme Court basically said that Justice Powell said, well, you know, you can consider race among a whole host of other considerations in a kind of holistic review. You can't have quotas, but you can do that in as much as it serves a compelling state interest. And that interest that was permissible was this idea of a diverse learning environment. So that's where this kind of idea of the diverse learning environment kind of started, and it kind of took off. And this is the one legal justification that has been accepted in courts and that has been used. And universities have really taken this on, and that's the language that they use. And so I think students hear it from their college counselors when they're in high school. They hear it again when they get to college. There's all this talk of diversity. And, you know, I think that, and on the one hand, I think that's positive. There's a lot of research to show that this diverse learning environment really does positively impact students of all ethnic backgrounds and racial backgrounds. But it also misses this larger question of inequality that you're talking about and the benefits to students who are you know, the targets of affirmative action.
Okay. So maybe then more of a good thing here than I initially thought. Point taken. But you call it the diversity bargain, though.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So tell us more about that.
Yeah. So the diversity bargain is this, that in the United States, that students are more likely to support affirmative action than, you know, most ordinary Americans. And ordinary Americans, I should say, a lot do support affirmative action, but are more divided. But they do so, white students do so in exchange for a few expectations. And I talk about three in the book. And the first one is that student, they expect students, Black and Latino students on campus who, you know, they assume all Black and Latino students have benefited from affirmative action, and then that they should integrate with their white peers. Because if affirmative action is about creating this diverse learning environment, when they notice, say, a table of Black students in the cafeteria or their Latino roommate joining the Latino Students Association, they feel like, well, isn't the point that you're here to integrate, and why are you in that minority space? And of course, you know, they don't always notice all the tables of white students in the cafeteria and don't understand how those, you know, minority dominant spaces might be important kind of support networks for those students. So that's the first one. The second kind of implication of this way of thinking about affirmative action is that white students sometimes had essentialized understandings of what it means to be Black or Latino. So they would say things like, well, you know, there was a Black student in my high school, but, you know, had a very quote unquote white experience, and that student shouldn't benefit from affirmative action. So it's often kind of linked to poverty. So there's this idea that in order to be seen as Black or Latino, you have to have had a certain kind of lived experience. So rather than expanding what it means to be Black or Latino in the United States, which is a range of class backgrounds, et cetera, that is sort of narrow understanding. And the third implication is what I call a kind of reverse discrimination script, yeah. Right? That if affirmative action is there to benefit me, then I'm very quick to claim reverse discrimination if I don't get something. So, you know, I had a white student say, if I hadn't gotten into Harvard, this is a student at Harvard, then I would have felt that I'd been discriminated against. If someone else that I knew and who was equally qualified and who was a minority, if they'd gotten in over me. So this is a student who got into Harvard, you know, arguably one of the hardest universities to get into, but it's, so I call it a script because it's already there. And imagine the student now going on to apply to graduate school or an internship or a job and not getting it. Affirmative action becomes a quick target. And again, because affirmative action is supposed to benefit that student, any, you know, loss or any setback can be easily attributed to.
So one thing that I hear in what that person told you is the impossibility of the other student, the student of color, actually being more qualified.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because,
I mean,
know,
I hate to say this, but like, isn't that kind of, that's just maybe an unconscious racism?
I don't think the student would say that. I think that, but you're right that it's this kind of catch-22, and it's like how it's, you know, there's no way to sort of, you know, explain that. And these, you know, these decisions are so competitive. Mm-hmm. You know, these colleges have admission, these elite colleges have admissions rates that are, you know, well under, you know, close to 5%. And so for every one student who has, you know, a small kind of, has some kind of provision for affirmative action, there's 19 students who didn't get in, who, you know, may use that reverse discrimination script to sort of explain why they didn't get in.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, what then do you take away from your conversations with these students about the effectiveness or the appropriateness or just sort of the way that we talk about affirmative action? Because is what you're finding showing that that these young people have actually, you know, listened carefully to these national conversations their views are completely consistent with how we talk about affirmative action? Or is there a gap? Is there something that we're doing wrong here?
Well, I do think that, you know, especially when we think about higher education and the whole, you know, the whole like lead up to higher education in terms of college counseling and, you know, in high schools, is that we do need a shift in terms of, you know, really helping students understand the historical roots of racial inequality in the United States. And I do feel like we do not as good a job in helping students understand, you know, how it is that the fact that, you know, Black students were systematically excluded from these universities, and that, you know, when we have had all these means of social mobility, the GI Bill that was supposed to bring social mobility to these GIs coming back from war, how Black students were allowed to be excluded from these universities. And so there were all these ways in which racial inequality got perpetuated in the United States and specifically in higher education. But students don't really understand that. And we don't, you know, we don't teach about it in history class. We don't acknowledge that when we talk, universities don't talk about that when they talk about affirmative action.
You know, we did talk in detail about what some white students told you. And forgive me, I should have asked this earlier, but can we for a minute speak in more detail about what students of color told you about their views and perceptions of affirmative action?
Yeah. So students of color also talked about appreciating the diversity of their college environments and talked a lot about that. But they, you know, as you might expect, didn't see themselves, their role on campus as there to edify their white peers. And, you know, that got very tiring for them. And they, you know, they were there to get an education just like everyone else. And they talked about, you know, in the book, I also talk about kind of race relations on campus. And a lot of the students of color talked about these kind of pivotal moments of their childhoods in which they experienced a pretty serious kind of racial incident. You know, a teacher saying, well, I didn't expect you to be getting these kinds of grades. Look at the kids who are in the honors class. You don't look like them. And, you know, all kinds of stories like this. Mm. And so they bring those kind of experiences with them to college and you know, are unsure about what that experience on a predominantly white campus is going to be like. And that creates anxiety in them, you know, and there are these kind of experiences in which they feel they've experienced a kind of what they call what we call microaggression, where white students, you know, seemingly, you know, unintentionally kind of offending or saying something insensitive. And this, you know, these were kind of regular experiences.
No, if I may, you're on the faculty at Harvard, elite amongst the elite.
Yes.
You're also a woman of color.
Yes.
I mean, have you ever personally grappled with any of this?
You know, that's a good question. As a faculty, you're putting me on the spot. As a faculty member, you know,
it's
you're
live
kind
radio,
of
forgive me.
I'm in a slightly different position. You know, I teach classes on race and ethnicity at Harvard, and so I feel like what my role in this university is more to kind of help students is to create a space in which students can grapple with some of these issues and talk to each other and have open and honest conversation about some of these issues and not have so much anxiety about. I mean, there is anxiety, but be able to sort of get past that. Because I think really that's what we need, and we need more spaces for students to be able to engage with each other.
By the way, so why did you talk to folks at Oxford?
So I was really interested. So there's two parts to the story.
Yeah.
One is that I was based in the UK. I was on the faculty at the University of London at the time. I'm from the United States. And living in the UK, I was really struck by how the ways that people talk and think about race is so different than the United States. So that's sort of across the board. And then within higher education, I was struck by the kind of lack of attention to diversity. You know, in the United States, we have departments of African American studies. Sometimes we have a lot of universities have ethnic studies. There's a lot of discussion, and you know, now that I'm on the faculty at Harvard, we have a lot of discussion about increasing diversity among our students and faculty. We have deans of diversity. There was really none of that in Britain, and again, I was really struck by how that just wasn't on the table. We weren't talking in faculty meetings about how to increase access to our universities, and so I started thinking about how these different experiences in higher education might shape the way that students think and talk about admissions and race very differently, and that's sort of what led me to this comparison.
So my last question is this is really interesting because when we're talking about these young people at elite colleges and universities, we're also talking about some of our future leaders.
Yes.
Right? And correct me if I'm wrong, but one takeaway I'm getting from this is that perhaps support for affirmative action is possibly more tenuous than we would think it is. That there's robust institutional support.
Yeah.
Harvard and others as institutions have gone to court to defend affirmative action. But we're talking about individual students here where, you know, as long as it's couched in terms of it benefits you and your learning environment, people are for it. But but when you turn the benefit away from them personally, perhaps their support is a little more tenuous. And I mean, and those are attitudes that they've they'll likely take with them off campus into their futures. I mean, am I reading too much into that?
No, that's absolutely true. And that's one of the things I say in the book, is that why I care about these students on these elite campuses and what they think so much is that they are our future leaders. They're going to take those ideas about fairness and what's a fair system of selection as they go off and become, you know, employers and they're making hiring decisions, or policymakers and they're deciding, you know, on the welfare state, or working in the media and shaping the discourse and how we think and talk about race and fairness and equity. And so I think that this is it is very important how they're thinking about this. And it's very problematic and worrisome that there's a lack of talk of racial inequality and the way that that impacts students' lives.
Well, the book is The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. It's by Natasha Wariku. She's an associate professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Really fascinating book. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So I'm old enough to remember that back in January, then White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer used his first appearance at the White House podium to issue a falsehood-riddled defense of the crowd size at President Trump's inauguration.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe.
Hashtag totally not true. Yesterday at the Emmy Awards, the same now former White House press secretary, aided by an introduction from Stephen Colbert asking about the size of the show's audience, well, Sean Spicer made a joke about it.
I mean, is there anyone who could say how big the audience is? Sean, do you know?
To witness an Emmys, period, both in person and around the world.
All that laughter and cheering was because Spicer's cameo had him rolling onto the Emmy stage on a podium similar to the one used by Melissa McCarthy on Saturday Night Live. Yay, hooray, Mr. Spicer, you can laugh at yourself. But some people, yours truly included, were not laughing. If anything, I'd say the joke is actually on Hollywood for its quick and opportunistic embrace of Spicer. And joining me now to either affirm or negate my opinion is Ty Burr. He's a film critic and cultural columnist at the Boston Globe. Hello, Ty.
Hello, Meghna. I'm just, like, tempted to keep you in suspense for as long as possible here.
Am I taking this too seriously? Because I didn't think it was funny at all.
You know, I got a laugh, and the more I thought about it, the more it just didn't sit well with me. The more it struck me as a moment like the great tousling of Donald Trump's hair by Jimmy Fallon. It's that iconic moment where you get the sense that the entertainment community, for all the lip service they give to their political beliefs, which of course has a controversial effect on the audience, whether you agree with them or not, doesn't really get out of its bubble, isn't really serious about what they say, is somehow thinking that it's all entertainment on some level. And it didn't sit well with me, and I'm glad to hear that it didn't sit well with you. And, you know, maybe are we taking it too seriously? I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know what? In the past, I probably would have been like, Meghna, get off your high horse, your soapbox, your whatever. You are taking this too seriously. But these are not normal times. I mean, Sean Spicer stood at the podium with the symbol of the White House behind him for six straight months and issued, you know, reality challenge after reality challenge statement. And now here we have Hollywood, like, giving him a high five and saying, ha ha. I mean, the greater criticism needs to go on Hollywood, because before the election, all the great Hollywood elites were throwing money at the Democratic Party, for better or for worse. They made a lot of money off of Spicer himself by mocking him, and now embracing him, it just feels yucky to me.
Agreed. But let us keep one thing in mind. I mean, we take our entertainers as serious political mouthpieces at our peril. And while I'm actually somebody who says, I believe that people should state their political beliefs, and if they have that forum and they win a prize, they can use that time to say whatever they want. I don't begrudge them that, whether I agree with it or not. But at the same time, these are people whose job is make believe. That's what they do, and there is a blurry line there. And I think especially with Stephen Colbert, who, let us not forget, was playing a part for many, many years in his previous show. And we're also, last night at the Emmys was also a celebration of a comedy show, Saturday Night Live, which hasn't been relevant in decades, all of a sudden feels like it's on the pulse of what's going on. And in fact, it's replaced the Daily Show, the Jon Stewart as, well, here's where you get to, here's where you go to get the interpretation, the comic, ironic, but true interpretation of the news.
Yeah.
But there's still all these gray areas and blurry lines. And I think last night you saw one of the, what happens when you blur those lines? You have somebody whose job was basically 24-hour mendacity, being welcomed into the fold. Well, you don't do it anymore, and we knew it was just your job. And it didn't sit well with me.
Yeah, I don't. I feel the same. You know, you do your job, but then there are certain lines, especially when, you know, your job is representing the most powerful person on planet Earth, you know, that perhaps the bar ought to be higher. But we have about 15 seconds left, Ty. What about the question of Hollywood normalizing Sean Spicer and all he did while White House press secretary?
Well, you know, that's exactly the word that was on my mind. It's not normalizing Sean Spicer. It's the creeping normalization of Donald Trump and the Trump administration. And here we are. We're coming into October. It's been 10 months. And we're getting used to it. And that's the thing that I think we should guard against.
Ty Burr, film critic and cultural columnist. And today, the affirmer of Meghna's high-minded opinion from the Boston Globe. Thanks so much, Ty.
You and me, Meghna. It's you and me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.